Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. This is As It Is. We come to you every day with interesting stories from around the world. Our aim is to tell you about important events and help you learn and improve your American English. If you are listening to our program on the radio, please find a way to let us know where you are listening and what frequency you are hearing. If you are listening on the Internet, be sure to download and save the program as a podcast. That way you can go back and listen to it again and again. To learn to speak English the American way, try saying the words and sentences the way we do. Start slowly with just one sentence, then try two. Next, you should try saying a whole paragraph. Remember, we always speak more slowly than normal, and we try to use words and thoughts that are easy to understand. Today we have a special program. Jill Robbins joins us to talk about Asia. Developing countries there are building businesses and homes, but not enough trains, roads, and bridges. Some new bank programs are beginning to lend money for the purpose of building the needed facilities. So let's turn things over to Jill for all the details. Jill?
One Monday morning in Manila, cars moved in a slow line along the main avenue. Taxi driver Ranilo Banez shook his head at the long line of cars. Crowded roads have become more common as Manila's economy grows. Mr. Banez said a 10-kilometer, or 6-mile, trip that once took 30 minutes may now take up to 2 hours. "We lose so much," Mr. Banez, 64, said. "We waste a lot of gasoline and time." In Manila and other cities in Asia, people are building mini office and apartment towers. But the building of roads, railways, and other important infrastructure has been slower, in part because of the 1997 financial crisis. Before the 1997 financial crisis, many developing Asian countries spent 6 to 8% of their yearly economic output on public works. After the crisis, that amount dropped to as little as 2%. Ramesh Subramaniam is the Deputy Director General of the Asian Development Bank's Southeast Asia Department. He says that developing countries have a lot of work ahead of them to build the necessary facilities. If spending does not increase, then this could possibly have an impact on future growth, Subramaniam said. Certainly, it is going to reduce the competitiveness of the countries in the region. In May, Philippines President Benigno Aquino III approved $1.4 billion in spending for commuter trains in Manila and other projects. That brought the total for infrastructure investment to $31.8 billion since Aquino took office in 2010. The Philippines is not the only Asian country struggling to deal with crowded roads. In India, Prime Minister Narendra Modi called for his country to speed up building all projects that will ensure a modern infrastructure backbone. India's biggest program is the $100 billion Delhi-Mumbai Industrial Corridor Project. That plan will create 7 industrial cities, high-speed railways, 6 airports, and 3 seaports. The government says India also needs 450 new power plants that use coal. To keep that up, India needs to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure for the next 5 years. In Vietnam, the government approved a proposal in June for a new airport. It will be located near Vietnam's business capital, Ho Chi Minh City, and cost $15.8 billion. The country also plans to spend $22.5 billion on new highways. The demand for power in Vietnam also increases by 10% every year. State media say Vietnam needs to spend $125 billion in the next 20 years to keep up with the demand. Thailand has a $92 billion building plan for the next few years. The plan includes high-speed train routes that will run from China in the north through Malaysia in the south to Singapore. It calls for expanding seaports and Bangkok's commuter trains. But many countries still do not know how they will pay for these projects. The Asian Development Bank has estimated that developing Asian economies need to invest $8 trillion in the 10 years leading up to 2020. Japan and the United States are the principals behind the Asian Development Bank. Japan has announced a credit plan of $110 billion in aid to pay for Asia's infrastructure projects. China has said it wants to be a regional leader in investing in infrastructure projects. More than 20 other countries joined with China to open the new Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, or AIIB. The bank is expected to start with $100 billion in capital, mostly from China. The Asian Development Bank said building the needed facilities will help people in the region earn more money. If the needed facilities are built, people there could get an extra $4.5 trillion in income in the decade through 2020, and another $8.5 trillion after that. But many of the planned projects do not have a business plan that promises to produce profits and repay investors. And investors worry about the government interfering or possible delays over environmental and other concerns. Still, Mr. Subramaniam of the Asian Development Bank said the region's total spending is likely to be less than half the amount required. He says Asia still needs more resources and different ways to pay for the projects. I'm Jill Robbins.
You are listening to The Voice of America. We come to you every day from Washington.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Economics Report. The Swiss-based World Economic Forum released its latest Global Competitiveness Report this week. The report rated Switzerland as the world's most competitive country for the seventh year. Next on the list were Singapore and the United States. Others among the top 10 were Germany, the Netherlands, Japan, Hong Kong, Finland, Sweden, and Britain. The report said countries need to accept the reforms needed to improve productivity. They also need to support entrepreneurs. If not, the report says, the countries will be less competitive. It says promoting productivity is important for growth and to lower unemployment. Most countries report economic growth, but growth is weaker than before the 2008 financial crisis, the report says. The report warns developing countries which fail to compete enough will not be able to deal with future shocks to the world economy. Margareta Drzenia Canuz is head of Global Competitiveness and Risk at the World Economic Forum. She says digital technology in machinery and manufacturing is important worldwide. But it is the human factor that is critical to competitiveness, she says.
By human factor, we include two broad categories of issues. One is education and everything related to education. So how do countries nurture talent? But also the flexibility of the labor market. So the ability of the business sector to adapt to changes in the countries.
The 2015-2016 report used 12 pillars or groupings to rate a nation's competitiveness. These include roads and other infrastructure, health and primary education, business sophistication, and innovation. Major findings show the larger emerging markets are making little progress in competitiveness. But the report notes India and South Africa appear to be exceptions. Both countries moved up in the ratings. The report says 28th-ranked China is the most competitive of this group of economies. But it says China's failure to move up in the rankings shows the country is facing some difficult economic issues. The report says African countries south of the Sahara continue to grow at close to 5% a year. But uneven commodity prices have hurt competitiveness and productivity. In sub-Saharan Africa, 46th-ranked Mauritius remains the area's most competitive economy. It is followed closely by South Africa and Rwanda. And that's the VOA Learning English Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, our weekly program of American history for people learning American English. I'm Steve Ember. Last week on our program, we talked about the election of 1840. William Henry Harrison easily defeated Martin Van Buren and became the 9th President of the United States. By that time, another political force was growing in the country. It did not come from Van Buren's Democratic Party, nor did it come from Harrison's Whig Party. It grew out of slavery. The dispute over slavery appeared to have been resolved for a time. A political compromise in 1820 kept a balance between slave and non-slave states. The compromise also barred slavery in the northern part of the Louisiana Purchase. But during the 1830s, the issue of slavery rose to the surface again. A major reason why the dispute came to life again was cotton. Cotton plants grew in many fields across the southern states. Black slaves planted, picked, and took care of the cotton crops. They also had other duties on southern farms. Northern ships then carried southern cotton to the markets of Europe. Manufactured goods needed in the South came from the North. The situation deeply troubled the political leaders of the South. They worried that cotton made their states economically dependent on the industrial North. What made things worse was the fact that most federal spending on public works projects went to the northern states. Then there was the old dispute over import taxes. Taxes on foreign goods mostly helped the manufacturers of the North. The taxes were to be lowered in 1842, but that was still years away. No one could be sure what would happen then. Such were the general political and economic conditions in the United States when the abolitionist movement began to make itself known. Abolitionism was an effort to end slavery and the slave trade. At first, religious groups organized the abolitionist movement. Then, in the 1830s, anti-slavery societies began operating in New York and New England. Many abolitionist groups published newspapers, pamphlets, and booklets. They flooded the country with anti-slavery petitions. Abolitionists believed slavery was evil and that there could be no compromise with evil. They did not like the idea that slaves should become free slowly over time, and they did not think slaveholders should be paid to free their slaves. They just wanted all slavery to disappear immediately.
They were regarded as this wild-eyed, fanatic group on the far left inside of the anti-slavery movement. People who were willing to do anything, radicals, they would upend society. This was the view that the people had of them.
Howard Jones is an historian. For many years, he taught at the University of Alabama. He says the abolitionists did not have much popular support. In the South, slavery was not a question of right or wrong. It was a question of survival. Some Southerners believed that without slavery, their whole economic system would lie in ruins. In the North, the abolitionists did not yet have major support. Some feared the abolitionist movement would weaken the rule of law. Even if they did not like slavery, these people believed the Constitution permitted it. As a result of the public feeling at the time, abolitionists struggled to communicate their message. Some states even sought to stop the flow of anti-slavery literature across their borders. In 1836, the House of Representatives declared it would not listen to any anti-slavery petitions. This decision became known as the gag rule. The Senate did not pass such a rule, but it did develop a complex, indirect method to delay action on anti-slavery petitions. Then something strange happened. Historian Howard Jones says some abolitionists believed the event was God's way of helping their cause. In August of 1839, a slave ship appeared in waters off the coast of New York. The ship was carrying two white Spanish-speaking men and about 50 men, women, and children from Africa. The captain was missing. American sailors stopped the ship and brought everyone to the mainland. No one knew what to do with the Africans. Were they criminals? Slaves? If so, who did they belong to? The Africans did not speak English or Spanish, so they could not explain themselves. The government jailed the Africans in New Haven, Connecticut, while officials tried to decide what to do. The slave ship was called the Amistad, and the case became known as the Amistad case. One of the leaders of the abolitionist movement, a man named Lewis Tappan, was very wealthy. Howard Jones says that Mr. Tappan sought to use the Amistad case to gain support for ending slavery.
What Tappan wanted to do was to use his almost unlimited financial resources to take these people to court, the Amistad captives, 53 of them, and show that they were human beings, that they had a right to be free.
The abolitionists found a free black man who spoke both English and Mende, the language of a few of the Africans. This translator helped explain what happened. The Mende said they had been kidnapped from their homes in West Africa. They were forced to march to the coast. There, white slave traders bought them. At that time, the United States, Spain, and many other countries had signed treaties to ban the international slave trade. The United States had also made buying slaves from Africa illegal, but the government did not enforce the law. A Portuguese ship brought the Mende and several hundred other captured Africans to Cuba. Many died of sickness, starvation, or beatings on the long trip across the Atlantic Ocean, which was called the Middle Passage. Those who survived were brought to a market in Havana. Cuba was a Spanish colony at the time. Spanish law said slavery was legal on the island, but the slave trade was not. To get around the law, many traders acted as if captured Africans had been living in Cuba as slaves for a long time. For instance, one of the young Mende men was named Sengbe Pie. Two Cuban middlemen bought him and about 50 other men, women, and children for farms on the other side of the island. The middlemen wrote his name in their records as Joseph Sinque. They gave the other Africans Spanish names, too, so it would seem like the Africans had been born in Cuba. Then they loaded the group onto a ship called the Amistad. a name that means friendship in Spanish, and chained them below deck. Historian Howard Jones says the Amistad was like a taxi.
It would transport slaves wherever you wanted them to be taken. Now, they weren't really slaves. They had never been enslaved, but they were called that at this point. That's a critical issue in this whole thing.
A few nights later, Sengbe Pie and some of the other Africans broke free. They found weapons and waited until sunrise. The next morning, Pie and his shipmates killed the captain of the Amistad and the cook. Two crew members escaped. The Cuban middlemen were the only white people who remained. The Africans said they would let the Cubans live, but only if they brought the ship back to Africa. The middlemen agreed. During the day, they sailed the Amistad southeast, but at night, they turned the ship northwest toward the United States, hoping to arrive one day in a friendly southern port. Nearly 2 months later, the food and water on the Amistad were gone. Several of the Africans took a small boat to land to get more supplies. The captain of a government ship saw them. He brought the Africans and the Amistad into port in the northern state of Connecticut. The Cuban middlemen told their side of the story. They said the Africans were slaves who had revolted and claimed the ship's passengers as property. The Spanish government agreed with the middlemen. It demanded that the ship and the Africans be returned to Cuba. Spain's queen said that Spanish law would decide what happened next. Martin Van Buren, who was president at the time, liked the Spanish idea. He did not want to cause problems with Southern voters and politicians. He wanted to avoid the issue. But it was too late. The captain of the government ship said the Amistad and the Africans on it belonged to him. He said he had found them and he had a right to sell the Africans as slaves. The captain gave the middlemen permission to go, and he gave the Africans to the U.S. government to decide the case. The charges against the Amistad Africans were serious. They were accused of being murderers and pirates. If they were found guilty, they could be enslaved for the rest of their lives or put to death. But the abolitionists claimed the Amistad Africans were something entirely different. They said the Africans were captives who had been kidnapped illegally. The Africans should not be punished, the abolitionists said, but returned to Africa. Historian Howard Jones says the abolitionists looked forward to presenting the case in court. They also hoped Sengbe Pie and the others could help with their communication problems. They wanted the Amistad Africans to tell Americans what life in Africa was like.
But more important than that, what it was like on the dread African slave trade, that middle passage, those thousands of miles of crossing the ocean to the New World, and then, by extension, throw a dark light on what slavery was like itself.
Whether Americans started to listen to the abolitionists and what happened to the Amistad Africans will be our story next week. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.